55 years ago today, the gales of November claimed the lives of 33 crew members of the SS Carl D. Bradley on Lake Michigan. The Bradley wreck doesn't get talked about as much as the Edmund Fitzgerald, but it is a story worth remembering. Current State's Melissa Benmark spoke with Bruce Lynn, the executive director of the Great Lakes Shipwreck Museum at Whitefish Point, about what happened that day.
It was November 17th, 1958. The Carl Bradley, if for any of you who've seen ships traveling in the Great Lakes, this at one time was the largest ship on the Great Lakes, 640 feet long, not that much shorter than the Edmund Fitzgerald. But it was one of those old stories. It was the last trip of the season, and they had unloaded some limestone down in Gary, Indiana, U.S. steel plant down there. And they were turning around, and they were headed back north. Home port was Rogers City. And they were approaching the Beaver Island chain. And to make a long story short, with 65-mile-per-hour winds and 20 to 20-foot waves, or 25-feet waves, the Bradley literally broke apart on the surface. It was about 12 miles southwest of Gull Island. And within a matter of minutes, this 640-foot vessel with its 35-man crew was sinking to the bottom of Lake Michigan. The interesting thing, I think, about this shipwreck is that there were two survivors. So you had 33 crew members that perished on the wreck. You did have two survivors. And so unlike, say, the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, where there were no survivors and we don't know exactly what happened, now we have two eyewitnesses that could tell that story of what was happening, what they saw with their crew and how quickly the ship sank, and so on and so forth.
I understand there were four survivors, but two of them didn't make it.
That's correct. Well, that's right. There was a life raft. And most of the information that I've researched comes from the survivor that's actually still alive, Frank Mays. He tells the story when the bow section of the ship rolled over and started to sink. He was ejected from the vessel, but was lucky enough to land very close to that life raft. So he saw much of what was happening, and it was soon after that the first mate of the ship, a gentleman by the name of Elmer Fleming, appeared near the raft, and Frank Mays pulled him on board. And then two other crew members came on board, but in the end, when the Sundew, the Coast Guard cutter, came through to rescue them, only Elmer Fleming and Frank Mays were alive at that point.
So Elmer Fleming is no longer with us then?
No. In the late 1960s, if I understand correctly, Elmer Fleming died of a heart attack.
But Frank Mays went on to actually dive the wreck of the Bradley, which blows my mind.
He did. He did. And one can only imagine what was going through his mind when he went down in that submersible and saw his old ship, you know, this beautiful, what was a beautiful ship at one time, in two pieces on the bottom of the lake. And I think that was one reason he wanted to go down, because there was some contention, a bit of a debate, whether that ship sank in one piece or if it went down in two pieces. And what can you say? Frank saw it happen.
Right, but wasn't there some kind of investigation that U.S. Steel, I think, was the owner of the ship at the time, and they had some investigation, and they said that it was in one piece?
That's correct. That's correct. That Bradley transportation line was owned by U.S. Steel. And U.S. Steel did indicate that after their investigation that it had gone down in one piece.
So Frank Mays saw it on the bottom in two pieces. That must have been really vindicating for him.
Absolutely. I can't imagine what was going through his mind. I mean, think of anybody going into 340, 350 feet of water in a submersible, much less you having been on a shipwreck in 1958, and now you're going down to the gravesite, really, of that wreck.
Does he kind of avoid talking about it now, or does he talk about it, his experiences at all? Or,
you know, he does a little bit. He did come to the Shipwreck Museum at one time and spoke about his experiences, but I don't think that he goes out on any kind of speakers tour or anything like that. I don't think that he does that a whole lot.
One of the other really striking details that when I was doing the research on this was how people all lined up on the beach, I guess at Charlevoix, with their car lights on when it went down looking for survivors.
That's right. Yeah, you had a lot of the Coast Guard families that were out there because you had two of those cutters, and there were even other vessels that were out there that night that were searching. But you had a lot of the Coast Guard families, but at the same time, you had a lot of those families from Roger City, from Sheboygan, from Onaway, places like that that were driving over because they knew, as terrible as that storm was, they wanted to be there when their family member was coming back. At least they were praying that they would see their family member come back alive.
The effect on Roger City must have been pretty profound. 23 of 35 crew members from there.
That's correct. And if you think, there was a statistic, and it was something like 53 children were now fatherless. And there was a statistic that this was suddenly the highest per capita orphaned children number on the Great Lakes immediately after that. And it all happened really in a matter of minutes, if you think about it.
You direct this museum, the Shipwreck Museum. You're right off of the observation of the 30th anniversary of the Fitzgerald. On kind of a philosophical level, I wonder, people have such a personal reaction to shipwrecks. It's almost more like a collective loss. It's not, I mean, the immediate family and relatives obviously have lost people very dear to them. But there's almost this collective loss that we feel, or many of us do anyway, like we all own it. Is this just a Great Lakes thing, do you think, because we live here? Or why do you think so many of us see these events, you know, as if they belong to us in some way?
That's an interesting question, and I've been asked questions like that before, and a lot of it revolves around this kind of continuing interest in the Edmund Fitzgerald. I don't think it's Great Lakes, and you know, a good example we always think about is Titanic. Everybody seems to have a connection to that, and a lot of times, personally, I know, I try to think of what I would have done under the circumstances. Or you read about these shipwrecks, you do research, you talk to surviving crew members who have been on shipwrecks, and you hear them recount the story, and I always find myself imagining myself in that position. I think people do that a lot. There is a little bit of romance behind these things, obviously not for the people that were going down on the ships, but the heroism, the courage. You think about people maybe sometimes doing certain things that will allow another member on the ship to survive, and they don't. Think about the heroism of the Coast Guard, typically, or even civilians, or even in some situation, lighthouse keepers going out and saving people off of shipwrecks. So it is interesting, that fascination that seems to cling to shipwrecks. And, you know, we see it every year up there at the museum. We have about 60,000 people a year that come through the museum. And it is interesting to talk to these people and find out why they're coming and what they're interested in. And you hear all kinds of answers, but a lot of it still revolves around that, just thinking in terms of the circumstances and what would I have done under those circumstances.
Kind of an interesting side note to this. Those of us who are familiar with the Shipwreck Museum will remember some monuments on the beach that some family members made for some men who were on the Fitzgerald. When I saw them, I remember them as laminated plywood, very homemade, and it would kind of blow your mind because it just someone made this in their basement or in their shop and put it on the beach, family members presumably. I understand that those are no longer there.
They're not there any longer, and it's an interesting story because Sunday night, November 10th, we had a ceremony, as you just mentioned. It's a memorial for the Edmund Fitzgerald crew, and every year we have family members that come up, and we had two of the families that lost, in one case, a son, and in the other case, a father, Bruce Hudson and Ransom Cundy, and then there was a third individual that were on those markers that you're referring. They're almost like headstones. But they're right on the shore of Lake Superior. We had just been talking about those headstones, if you want to call them that, just that very night with those family members, because they were kind of getting in rough shape. The pictures were fading. They get blasted by sand throughout the spring, summer,
freezing,
and fall. Well, the strange thing is, we believe that night, and that would have been 38 years ago to the day that the Fitzgerald sank, that we had a good strong wind blowing, and the waves came crashing in and swept those markers all away. 38 years to the night that the Fitz sank. Kind of boggles the mind a little bit.
Bruce Lynn, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.